Well, good morning, all, at least on behalf of me. I'm sure you were all greeted earlier. Our case for argument now is Philadelphia Indemnity versus Chicago Title Insurance. Mr. Eaton.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Tim Eaton. I represent Chicago Title Counsel. Your Honors, the primary issue in this appeal is whether the parties have the right to draw up a contract that defines the terms of their insurance relationship. Freedom to contract is an important, fundamental public policy firmly rooted in the Illinois Constitution and in case law. As this Court noted in 2011 in Clarity National Insurance versus Medina, Illinois courts have had a long tradition of upholding the right of parties to freely contract and declare contractual provisions void as contrary to public policy only when they are manifestly injurious to the public welfare or clearly contrary to what the Constitution, the statutes, or the decisions of the court have declared to be the public policy.
You know, you just said a magic word, which is Illinois courts.
Yes.
And so my first question to you relates to the complete defense rule, because I've been wondering if your argument about the applicability of that rule is one that really would be better addressed to the Illinois courts. I mean, our role with respect to state law is really limited to ascertaining what the Illinois Supreme Court has done or, you know, what it's likely to do. And, boy, it is far from clear, it seems to me, how the Illinois Supreme Court, you know, would respond to your arguments.
Two things, Your Honor. First, the Illinois courts have not addressed the issue, as we have been quite candid in our briefs, an issue of first impression. But secondly, we believe the law is clear in Illinois that absent a specific declaration of public policy, that parties are free to contract together and define the terms of their relationship. Here, there is an absence of any declaration of public policy with respect to the complete defense rule in any case in Illinois. The only case that the appellees point to is a case, home insurance, where there's a reference in dicta to the complete defense rule being a judicial rule. Other than that, all of the cases, I shouldn't say all, most of the cases have referred to policy language which says that the insurer is required to defend the suit, not a cause of action, but the suit.
Well, I think that's really the most important point here, which is to say that in predicting what the Illinois Supreme Court would do, there is no indication that the Illinois Supreme Court would extend the complete defense rule to this context. And so it's really your opponents who are asking for a change in Illinois law in that respect. They're asking us to extend the complete defense rule to a context that it has never been extended to before by the Illinois courts. So that, it seems to me, is a reason for us to apply the law as we know it and not extend it, which is what the district court did in this case.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. That is our view. In fact, after the Peppers case was decided in 1976, which did involve a liability policy that did involve language that said suit, the Illinois Supreme Court later in Zurich versus Raymark said that the parties could contractually limit the duty to defend. In that case, it did not involve a title insurance. It did not involve multiple counts. But it involved a policy where the indemnity obligation had ceased to exist because it had already settled a number of claims and there's no longer any money left. The court had no hesitation in saying in that case that the parties can define their rights by contract. and we believe that's important. Also, the Illinois Appellate Court, Your Honor, this is not the Illinois Supreme Court, but in Village of Lombard, which we also cited, was a case that did involve two counts, one covered, one non-covered, and the court found in that instance that the party who had the covered claim did not have to defend the non-covered claim. Separate counsel would be required, and that there was no public policy, and they used those words in that decision in the appellate court. There was no public policy against having multiple counsel involved in a case where you have that conflict between covered and non-covered.
Is that the punitive damages case?
It is. Yes, it was compensatory and punitive counts.
No.
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. The Illinois Supreme Court has never come out and said that the complete defense rule is one that turns on the language of the insurance policy, has it?
No. No, as a matter of fact, in the Seminole case, which is the Peppers case, what they did was they said what the complete defense rule was, and then they cited a number of cases that had preceded it as the basis for the rule. And if you go back to those cases have policy language which says suit. So the expectation of the insured was that there would be a coverage for the entire suit, not just for claims.
Actually, the Illinois cases that the Peppers Court cited don't have anything to do with the complete defense rule. It's only the out-of-jurisdiction cases that even have anything to do with it.
Right.
So it appears to be an anomaly rather than some sort of cardinal principle of public policy.
Right.
You would expect a state Supreme Court, if it were making a public policy determination as a matter of its common law power, that it would explain itself a little better.
And particularly, Your Honor, in light of language in cases that have dealt with public policy issues, they said they want a declaration of public policy, and without that, they will respect the party's freedom to contract. Here, as Your Honor pointed out, in the Peppers case, the word policy is not even used in that paragraph or two. And in decisions following it, they have looked to the language, and then they just look back to the complete defense rule, which has been applicable where you have a policy that where the expectation is to defend the suit. And title insurance is different. We defend dirt. Liability policies defend conduct of people. We have a one-time premium charge at the beginning when the title insurance is issued. In this case, it was $3,300, one-time payment, because we're looking back to see if there's good title. And at that point, then, the parties can be assured based on representation there is, and if we're wrong and there's a title dispute, we have to defend it. As opposed to Philadelphia, in this case, which is an errors and omission policy similar to liability policies, they charge a $25,000 premium annually. So if at some point it looks like the risk is going to be greater, they can increase the premium, because that policy is looking forward. That policy is looking at what may happen, not what has happened. So title insurance is different. And we do not believe that under these circumstances that the court should extend beyond just the liability policies, the complete defense rule, the title policies.
Sheen, do you think it's a case that the court should consider certifying to the Illinois Supreme Court?
Your Honor, I do not, and here's why. I mean, I certainly understand, particularly based on Judge Drobner's question. But in this case, I believe the case law is clear that based on freedom of contract, unless there is a declared public policy as to why certain language is injurious to the welfare of the state, that absent that, the Illinois courts will respect what the parties do by contract. So we do not believe this is even a close call that would require the Illinois Supreme Court to look at it. And I think, as Judge Sykes pointed out, I think the burden would be on the other side to persuade this court that the Illinois court really would extend it beyond what they already have.
And what should we make of the references to the complete defense rule in the however light those references might be in the intermediate appellate court, the Illinois appellate court. What if that's what we're to look to, what would you say we should take from their language?
Two things. One, I think they have looked at policies where, again, although they may not say it directly, there is language to the effect that it does involve a suit, and therefore that's what the parties intended the coverage would be for the entire suit. Secondly, they're not uniform, because as I cited in our brief, in the Village of Lombard case, where there was a compensatory and punitive count, they raised the issue, the insured raised the issue of public policy and the complete defense, and the court said no. Here, the language in the contract is clear that it is not to cover punitive damages, and we're going to respect that language absent a public policy against it. So, in my opinion, Your Honor, I think the appellate courts have applied it correctly based upon the types of suits that have been involved. Title insurance is sui generis because, again, we make a determination at the beginning as to what happened prior to that time, and so we can charge a smaller premium. And I think the ramifications of imposing that duty on title insurers would be that title insurance would become cost prohibitive. Right now, in this case, it was $3,300.
Well, it also would become, in a sense, coextensive, or at least insofar as the duty to defend is concerned, it would become coextensive with CGL policies or homeowners' other general liability policies, and that is clearly not the function that it's serving. And the fortuity principle in insurance law operates very differently with respect to title insurance than it does with respect to general liability insurance, which, you know, is entirely forward-focused.
Right, exactly.
And the risk is priced very differently.
The risk that we insure is the risk that relates to the title, and that is it. And that's why we can charge so little, because we can have some certainty as best we can when we do a title search that there's no liens on the title, or the title hasn't been, there's no cloud on the title, and so then we can charge a smaller amount. And what would happen is if this obligation were imposed and you had CGL policies, we would have to change our policy to have other insurance clauses. You have to be eroding limits. I mean, you're going to change the whole nature of title insurance. And I believe that's why the state of Illinois has treated title insurance differently by having it's not part of the Department of Insurance. It's in the Department, I think, of Financial and Professional Regulation. It's treated differently by statute. It's not in the insurance code. It's an entirely different animal. And that's why I don't think there's any doubt that when this policy is at issue, that it is limited to the risk that it insures. And by the way, yes.
Oh, no.
No, please.
Oh, you finish your thought, then I'll.
Okay. Yeah. What I was going to say, Your Honor, is that this is a foreign policy, ALTA policy, that's been around since 1992. This issue's never arisen. There's no case law. I don't think it's ever come to this type of situation before. I think it's just been well known that title insurance covers risk, and I think that explains why there's been very little, if any, case law in the country on this. There's just a few cases that have been cited. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, and by the way, thank you very much for pointing out that the case from the Northern District of Ohio was vacated.
I regret that we weren't able to determine that later, but we had shepherdized before we filed our briefs, and well, that's an old term, but Westlaw does not show it until.
But I thank you
out.
For that.
You bet.
What I was wondering was, practically speaking, how do you divide the obligation to defend if, as you say, the duty is limited to covered claims?
Often, Your Honor, you have one set of counsel covering the case. Like in this case, Schiff Hardin, very good law firm. It came down to a question of who pays what. We pay for the covered claim defense Philadelphia pays for the non-covered. And so it's a question of just who pays. Now, that's not always the case. In the Village of Lombard case involving punitive damages, the court believed in that instance that separate counsel might be required, and then it just becomes an allocation of paying counsel based upon an allocation of the number of counts. We, in this case, made an allocation based on the number of covered counts versus the number of total counts, and were willing to pay as to the original Chancery action 4/9 and as to a later action 2/12.
Should we? I'm not sure how time is being used right now, but should we go to the settlement between Philadelphia Indemnity and Western? Why does the settlement between Philadelphia Indemnity and Western Capital moot Western Capital's claim against Chicago Title if Western Capital has some duty to reimburse Philadelphia Indemnity depending on what it recovers in this litigation?
There's two points I would make to that, Your Honor. First of all, we believe that it mooted it because Philadelphia's claims are derivative of what Western Capital was seeking in terms of coverage. And once that's settled, we believe that based upon this court's decision in Taco Bell, that that mooted. Now, I'll be honest, that's not our strongest argument. I think that the settlement was brought, we found out about it through the course of discovery. There was a confidentiality clause, and we had to fight to get it. I think it really pertains more to the equitable subrogation, which is one of their cross appeals.
In view of Chicago Title's status as the primary insurer, it just seems like there's, you know, a live issue as to whether it's complied with its defense obligations to Western Capital.
At that point, based upon the court's ruling and summary judgment, that's true. And also, the district court did point out, and I'll be candid, the district court pointed out that even if that mooted Philadelphia's obligations, Western Capital still had a claim seeking a declaration on the same issue. So I understand.
Now you're into your rebuttal.
I am.
So.
There was just one other point which I wanted to raise quickly. We believe that the district court also erred in deciding that when claims have been dismissed with prejudice and then repled for purposes of preserving them for appeal under Illinois procedure, that those are not live claims and we should not be on the hook, and those should not be viewed as covered claims when they're simply being repled to preserve error for appeal. And as a result of that ruling, we were on the hook after the covered claims had been dismissed with prejudice but replayed solely for purposes of appeal, and we believe they were not active claims then.
The duty to defend, to the extent that it exists here against your client, doesn't persist beyond the trial court?
It would, and once those claims were on appeal, we would have an obligation, if they're appealing those, to defend.
Just not on an ongoing basis in the trial court is what your claim is.
Yes.
Oh, so you're still on the hook for defense costs for those claims to the extent they go up.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton.
Thank you.
Mr. Chambers?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. For Philadelphia Indemnity Insurance Company, Robert Chemers, with Scott Howey. I only have 13 minutes, and this will be like the lightning round based on the questions you posed to Mr. Eaton. Judge Sykes, with respect to the argument you heard by Mr. Eaton concerning the difference in title insurance, and that somehow because title insurance is different than liability insurance, it should be treated differently by the courts with respect to the duty to defend, is an argument which was waived in the district court. Granted, waiver is a doctrine that's binding on the parties but not binding on this court. But the district court found it waived because it was raised for the first time in connection with a motion to reconsider after summary judgment was entered. Also, They don't cite one case to indicate that the calculus of determining the duty to defend or how you determine the duty to defend is any different with respect to a title policy.
Their argument is that the duty to defend is contractual. So the contract language is always in play. It's not waived if the argument is based on the contract, which, as I understand, it has been from the beginning.
Their argument was that the Illinois Insurance Code somehow treats title policies differently than liability policies.
That's a tangential point. The main point here is what the scope of the duty to defend is in Illinois law, and whether it extends, as you contend and the district court held, to insurance policies that are claim limited, that don't use the language of a standard duty to defend clause in a liability policy, which is to say that the insurer promises to defend a suit. That's not what this policy says. This insurer has promised to defend certain claims relating to the title. It has never promised to defend a suit. And all of the cases relied on by you and by the district court for the complete defense rule pertain to insurance policies, general liability policies that contain a covenant on the part of the insurer to defend a suit.
Or a claim.
Or a cause of action.
Correct.
That's different. Not a claim. Or a cause of action, not specific limited claims. There isn't a single case whereby any Illinois court has extended the complete defense rule to this kind of policy language or this context. It's all been limited to general liability policies where the insurer undertakes the complete defense of the suit.
We have cited to this court cases involving title policies which have embraced the so-called complete defense rule. Not in Illinois. One from Texas and one from Ohio. And the fact that the Ohio case...
It was vacated,
but not because of anything in its decision as to its merits. It was vacated because of a settlement agreement.
Those decisions are not authoritative.
They're not authoritative to this court, but they're the only cases out there. They haven't cited a case that says title insurance is different.
Don't need to. It's a differently phrased policy. The position that you're advocating for is the extraordinary one in this litigation. You're advocating for an extension of the complete defense rule into a context where it has never been recognized outside this Texas district court case
that you've cited.
Not authoritative, and it's you've got to come up with something that's better than that for us to conclude as a matter of Illinois public policy, as a federal court sitting in diversity, that we ought to extend the complete defense rule to this context, and then you have to identify some policy reasons on which we would do that.
The Illinois Supreme Court in the Peppers case, which we don't disagree is the seminal decision, says that where there are multiple claims or causes of action against an insured, if one is covered, there's a duty to defend all of them.
Right. That's a general liability policy in that case.
A general liability policy, but there has been nothing shown that a title policy would be considered any
differently. The language of the policy is very different.
The language of the policy in the various Supreme Court cases, as well as the decisions of this court embracing Peppers, and this court did so in Manikas, in Solo Cup, in Pipefitters, in Ohio Casualty versus Basie. There are almost as many cases from panels of this court applying Illinois diversity law to this coverage issue as there are cases out of the Supreme Court.
With general liability policies.
And yet, not one of those cases refers to the policy language when it refers back to the Peppers case.
In the context of insurance cases, which are contract cases,
right,
at their foundation, the decisions have to be premised on the contract language, the policy language, unless they're explicitly grounded in the public policy of the state. And if that's the case, the court has a duty to explain, as a matter of law, why it is implying in a duty that implying a duty that is extra-contractual. None of the cases have explained that, so we must assume that they are contract cases, interpreting the contract language, their contract interpretation decision.
We have Chicago Title Insurance Company's own reservation of rights letter, which is set forth in their appendix, in which they admit that count 14, which is one of the nine counts directed at their insured, Western Capital, is covered. And they admit they have a duty to defend count 14, and then that they then point out there are three other counts that may fall within their obligation to defend, which is why they then state in that reservation of rights letter, and that position has been their mantra throughout this litigation, that they would pay four-ninths of the defense cost.
Right,
which
that's not a concession that the complete defense rule applies. Otherwise, they would concede they have to defend the whole suit.
No, but then the argument made was to say that you provide coverage for less than all claims where there is a duty to defend an admittedly covered claim is contrary to Illinois law. It's contrary to Illinois law based on Peppers. And that was the law.
Only if Peppers applies in this context. No. And I'm suggesting to you it does not on its face because it has to do with general liability policies that contain very different language than a title policy.
What I would love to know is why did Chicago Title have a duty to defend during the two so-called blackout periods when there was no covered claim pending period?
Your Honor, with respect to that question, if there's a duty to defend a covered claim and that extends to all claims, the blackout period was a time where there still was a covered claim that was not yet on appeal. The argument they made was once that covered claim has been dismissed, their obligation to the insured is over. The obligation is over unless, which their argument would be they wouldn't have an obligation to defend the insured in connection with a motion to reconsider.
Well, this is something else I'm having a bit of a problem with. Covered claim has been disposed of, but was repleted solely to preserve it for appeal.
Correct.
Why is it pending in a meaningful sense, such that Chicago Title would have a duty to provide a defense? Because basically, I think what you would then be saying is that if on day two of litigation, the sole covered claim is dismissed, but it's repleted solely to preserve it for appeal, the insurer has to continue defending potentially for years, years and years thereafter, while the other non-covered claims are handled in the trial court. And I'm you know, conceptually just having difficulty.
I understand. A panel of this court in 1980 in the Solo Cup case held that there was a duty to defend until the claim for recovery was confined to a non-covered claim. The argument would be that where the covered claim, count 14, was dismissed, but not dismissed with prejudice or with finality, there would still be an ongoing duty to defend the other claims. There is an ongoing duty to defend until the covered claim is dismissed or disposed of with finality. The argument you just heard from Mr. Eaton was there would be a duty to defend a dismissed covered claim if it goes up on appeal, which is contrary to what they argued in their brief. They had a bright line where when that covered claim was gone through a dismissal order, with or without prejudice, there was no longer a duty to defend. We argued in our appellee brief that even they would have, under their own argument, no duty to defend the appeal on the other side of their own bright line. The other argument you heard, Your Honors, was about the premium. Again, that's an argument
I'd like to sort of, if and when the trial court's disposal of the claims were challenged on appeal, then perhaps Chicago Title's duty, maybe not even perhaps, to defend would kick back in and it would be obliged to handle the appeal. But I just don't see, once a trial court has dismissed or otherwise, you know, disposed of a claim, and there's no further litigation on those claims in a trial court, how there can be an obligation to supply a defense.
Because that dismissed claim was not confined, or the litigation was not confined to what would be a non-covered claim, which is what this Court said in the Sears case in 1982, what it said in Solo Cup in 1980. There are a long line of cases from this Court that say the duty to defend continues until the recovery is limited or confined to an uncovered claim. And that's not the scenario with the so-called blackout periods. Our position was we should have been, that there was a continuing duty to defend during that blackout period.
I have to be very honest with you. I'm not cognizant particularly of Solo. I remember it actually from, but in that case, did we have the repleting for purposes of appeals solely?
No. You had multiple claims, some of which were covered, one
right.
And some are not. And it talked about the continuing duty to defend until the only claim alleged was not covered. I would mention the premium argument that they took a small premium and have a large exposure. It's not for this Court to extricate them from a bad deal. Also, that argument was waived in the district court. Judge Flom, you asked about the certification to the Illinois Supreme Court. I dare say our Supreme Court would likely follow Peppers, its decision in 94 in National Union versus Glenview Park District.
What do you base that on? That they would extend Peppers?
That's their body of law, that where there are multiple claims.
Do you concede that this represents an extension of Peppers?
It represents a distinction in the sense that it's not a liability policy, but we couldn't find a case that says title policies are treated any differently. We couldn't find a case that said it's limited.
It's never been applied. Peppers has never been applied to title policies, so it would be an extension of Peppers.
This would be that case.
And on what basis do you assert so confidently that the Illinois Supreme Court would extend the rationale in Peppers, which was quite
because there are a number of Illinois appellate decisions involving title policies, and the duty to defend was determined.
Involving title policies?
Title policies. Rakowski is one, which we cited in our appellee brief, and they determined the duty to defend in that case no differently than they determined the duty to defend with a CGL policy. That is, they look to see if there is a covered claim. If there's a covered claim, there's a duty to defend.
I thought you told me that the complete defense rule has never been applied in the context of title
insurance. That was not the complete defense rule. That was looking at a complaint involving a title claim and how they determine if there was a duty to defend.
It has nothing to do with the complete defense rule then.
No.
Okay.
And we have a, if I could just wrap up in 30 seconds, we also have a cross appeal. We would ask the court to reverse with respect to the cross appeal. It's equitable subrogation. My client did the primary did not do, and that is it stepped up, it settled with the insured, it began to defend when Chicago Title refused to defend everything. The trial court found that the first two of the three elements of equitable subrogation had been satisfied. The third element, which was extinguishing the liability, they said we didn't extinguish the entire liability of Chicago Title, also that notice was an issue. But under our Supreme Court decision in Home versus Cincinnati, notice was a suggestion, it's not a requirement. And to disallow equitable subrogation under these circumstances would, in effect, punish Philadelphia for doing what it was contractually obligated to do, that is, step up when the primary carrier refused or failed to provide what I will call the complete defense. And it would be to the benefit, it would punish Philadelphia for doing the right thing. And it would allow Chicago Title to walk. So it asks the court as to the complete defense rule, if that exists, to affirm, and on the cross appeal to reverse. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chambers. Mr. Ray?
May it please the court. My name is Brian Ray, and I represent Western Capital Partners. The two areas of this appeal that have not been addressed by either counsel. The first relates to the blackout periods, but it relates to whether affirmative defenses can be covered. This court's inquiry focused on from September 2011 going forward when the counterclaims were actually repled.
Well, in the brief you say that Chicago Title had a duty to defend during these so-called blackout periods based on the affirmative defenses that were raised by the Cook parties. But affirmative defenses are defenses. They aren't claims against Western Capital that expose it to liability. So why do they matter in terms of the duty to defend? I'm having trouble with that.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And you need to look at the case that we cite, Associated Bank versus Stewart Title. That's in the District of Minnesota. And they are interpreting identical policy language in that case where it specifically refers to causes of action and claims. And what the court says there is that the same sentence where it defines, or it doesn't define, but where it states causes of action, it also states a claim. It specifically says right before the comma that if the insured is in litigation, that they will defend any adverse claim. And here, importantly, the language in the policy does not define causes of action and does not limit the type of pleadings that would apply. And so I submit to you that the better interpretation would be that any legal remedy, what is the definition of cause of action, for example? It's not defined in the policy. But if there's a legal remedy being asserted by one party against the other that causes that other party to not be able to enforce its $2.7 million mortgage, that's an adverse claim. And also, we believe that during those periods of time, the substance of the claims never changed. It's important to note that Judge Kennelly, in his summary judgment order, noted that during these periods of time, the Cook entities still had a relentless attack on the enforceability and priority of Western Capital's mortgage. It was fraud. It was fraud in the inducement. And that's why Chicago Title is incorrect in saying all we do is insure title, the state of title, as of the date of the policy. Not true. Look at Section 5 of the policy itself, the covered risks. Number 5 is the invalidity and unenforceability of the lien and mortgage. And what that means in this context is when there's a fraud claim challenging the invalidity and enforceability of that mortgage, it's a covered risk. And so when I may
sound like a simpleton to you, but were these claims against Western Capital that would expose it to liability? Are these claims against Western Capital?
The problem is these claims are pending to this very day, and they have not been well defined. Whether the question is, can that fraud claim result in a monetary judgment against Western Capital? I don't think that's fully materialized down below. But what is before this court is that it can result in Western Capital not collecting its $2.7 million loan by enforcing those mortgages. And that is a direct impact. That is a covered risk.
At least some of them are related to title challenges, right?
I'm sorry?
At least some of the affirmative defenses are title challenges.
No doubt. And they're challenging our mortgage, which is the only reason we retain them by contract, of course, as you've noted, to insure this risk. And there's no substantive difference as the Associated Bank versus Stewart Title. And keep in mind, it's their policy. They had the opportunity to define causes of action, but they didn't. They used the word adverse claim in the same sentence as they used causes of action. And so when you're forced with these two interpretations, we urge you to take the insured's interpretation here, because to do so otherwise, especially in complex litigation like this, where there's 14 counts, and then it mutates into 12 counts, and then it mutates again into another motion to dismiss, because it's ever evolving, but the substance is Western Capital, my client, would never be there if it wasn't an attack on the mortgage. That's the only reason this lawsuit was filed by the Cook entities.
How many of the affirmative defenses are cognizable as attacks on the title?
I don't have the list of all affirmative defenses right now, but the only one that matters is the fraud affirmative defense, which we gave them notice of in July of 2008. Keep in mind, Chicago Title was a defendant in this case.
Well, a fraud affirmative defense is very different than an attack on title.
The fraud defense that I understand it, as alleged by the Cook entities, is that it was fraudulently obtained, the mortgage itself, because there was not necessary member entity approvals and that there was some irregularities in the execution of those documents. That's the covered risk Chicago Title agreed to enforce, that our mortgage, as presented and as insured, would be enforceable and not subject to a collateral attack by fraud, by lack of authority, or irregularities in the execution of these documents. This is precisely the type of covered risk. Just because complex litigation takes different forms, it's not a meaningful distinction, according to the Associated Bank Court.
So it's a fraud claim with respect to the lien itself.
Precisely. Okay. It's an attack on WCP's mortgage. And I am eager to answer more questions about this, but I'm also eager to show you, aside from the complete defense rule, the allocation rule as applied by Chicago Title.
There is no such thing as an allocation rule, so I would suggest you drop that term.
Yeah. No problem. The contract as applied by Chicago Title in this case demonstrates this rises to the level of consumer fraud. And I want to explain why it's unfair practices the way this was applied.
Okay. Okay. So, while you do this, help me. In what sense are the claims of deceptive or unfair practices meaningfully distinct from the conduct underlying Western Capital's breach of contract claim against Chicago Title?
Well, they do relate to the same ideas, and yes, there's some contract elements involved in this claim, but it's not every to hold otherwise would mean that, keep in mind, every consumer that engages with a business is under a contract, implied or otherwise. If you're giving goods for services, there's a contract. And so I don't think it's a meaningful argument to say just because these conduct relates to the contract that it can't be consumer fraud. What Suzuki versus Denny shows is that when a consumer is left with no meaningful choice but to submit to their approach, take it or leave it, then a different calculus is presented. In Clark Mall, for example, which I agree are some different facts here, but it's important to note when it's a facade of compliance with contractual obligations. Let's show the facts and talk about them, why it's a facade of compliance in this case. What did they agree to pay? Well, at first they agreed to pay 25% in October of 2008. 14 days later, that changed to 44%. But they never paid 44%, and they never intended to pay 44%. Why? Because in November of 2008, 9 months after we submitted the claim, for the first time, they apply unpublished internal attorney fee guidelines to strike on a line item by line item basis our validly incurred legal fees. They never told us about these guidelines. They never told counsel Chip Hardin about these guidelines. They demonstrate that they never intended to comply with this 44%, even if they're right under the contract to apply that. They were going to apply these attorney fee guidelines, which, guess what? Judge Kennelly said in his summary judgment order, the second one, that they weren't part of the policy. And they've appeared to abandon this argument on appeal. They agree with Judge Kennelly that they never disclosed these guidelines. And so when you lure the insured into believing that you're going to pay something, and then you pay something less, it's deceptive and it's unfair, especially when during that time we're forced to incur $265,000 in attorney's fees. During the supplemental tender in December of 2009, when the claims were refiled, we submitted a new claim. We didn't hear from them for an entire year, December of 2010, when they said we'd pay 17%. But guess what? They didn't pay 17%. They paid 17% with a line item by line item deletion of attorney fee invoices they unilaterally determined didn't comply. During that year, this is critical, during that year, Western Capital incurred $349,000.
Wasn't the reason for the line item strikeouts to distinguish the fees that were incurred for true defense costs and the fees that were incurred for coverage issues?
Not at all, Your Honor. These attorney fee guidelines were applied to time items that were expressly incurred for covered claims. The 44% they took off the top, okay? So they would take 44% off the total invoice, which they say is per the contract. But then they would do line item by line item if it's multiple attorney conferences, for example, if it's whatever didn't comply. So no, They promised to pay 44% of covered claims, but in our view, it was deceptive and unfair when they don't disclose 9 months after the claim what we're going to now hold you to, when that's not in the policy. If the policy, as you've aptly noted, governs the contractual relations of the parties, this shows in Clark Mall it's a facade of compliance. They didn't intend to ever comply. It's manipulative. It's deceptive. And I understand also in the Western O'Neill versus National Union case that it can be a deceptive practice to conceal at the front end that you're not going to promptly pay claims, that you're not going to give them a fair claim determination. It took a year for the supplemental claim to even get a response. It took 9 months for the initial claim to even get a response. And guess what? If Western Capital didn't have the money to afford Schiff Hardin's fees during this period...
Let me ask you about that. This is a $2.8 million loan.
Correct.
How much you spent on the attorney's fees? You're well over $1 million.
$1.1 million is what Western Capital's paid down below, not to mention what we paid in Judge Kennelly's court and before you.
I guess it's just an interesting observation about litigation that on a $2.8 million issue...
But
you've got this kind of money in attorney's fees.
Exactly. And you've also got Schiff Hardin's affidavit before you that says he spent, Mark Fisher, spent 85% of his time defending undisputedly covered claims. Yet they didn't want to talk to Mark Fisher and ask about that. They wanted to apply their own allocation rule of 44%. It's really 44% less than that. So it shows why allocation's not feasible, because it unreasonably shifts the burden and cost of litigation to the insured. If 85% is the undisputed evidence and unrefuted is what actually was spent on covered claims, yet they only paid 44% minus the attorney fee guidelines, it shows 40% of those fees, which were undisputedly spent on covered claims, gets paid for by the insured. That is what happens when you apply the rule they're asking you to apply.
Are you suggesting there should have been some sort of disclosure in advance of signing the contract with Chicago Title on the question of attorney's fees in the event of litigation?
Yes, and we think that he did disclose this in the website. If I can read the one sentence, which I don't know how this can be interpreted as anything but deceptive in light of their conduct. If a claim is made against your insured title, CTI protects you by defending your title in court, if necessary, at no cost to you. Not subject to the policy conditions, not subject to the exclusions, not count by count, depending on how we determine it. No, that's the website that's undisputed we relied upon. Our attorney reviewed it before we agreed to submit to the borrower's request to use Chicago Title. That's the deception in advance of our contractual relationship. And at no cost to you wasn't even close to accurate. Not even close. And so when you're forced with this take-it-or-leave-it mentality, I'm sorry, I just saw the red light. When you're forced with this take-it-or-leave-it mentality, this way or the highway, we don't have a meaningful choice. And because of that, we believe Judge Kennelly erred in not letting our consumer fraud claims go before the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ray. Mr. Eaton.
We said we would defend the title, and we did. And let me come back to a couple points. Whenever I hear the word waiver, I shudder. But the waiver that counsel is referring to was we raised a number of arguments with respect to why title insurance is different. One argument was a regulatory scheme. We raised it in a reply brief, and the judge, in a motion reconsidering, the judge said that argument has been waived. It had nothing to do with the issue. From day one, we said because this is title insurance, it does not cover non-covered claims, and you have to look at the policy itself. Number two, and I think in response, Judge Sykes, to your question to me, if this resurrects itself on appeal, will we have an obligation? I said yes. Likewise, a motion to reconsider. But they're dead claims now. If you look at the supplemental appendix at page 65, we have the order.
Did you just say they are dead claims?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Because because in the supplemental appendix, we cite the judge's order where she dismissed them with prejudice, covered counts, and said these may be repled solely for the purpose of preserving issues for appeal. Those are not live issues, and we think that the trial court, district court, erred by saying that we're responsible for that. Judge Sykes, to answer your question with respect to affirmative defenses on fraud, that related to the lender's conduct, not to title. They were saying that the lender did not look adequately at whether or not certain documents had been signed by who and sorting through all those. It was not a cause of action attacking the lien. It was a cause of action attacking, an affirmative defense, which was attacking the lender.
So it's not so much an argument that affirmative defenses are never covered, or never fall within the coverage of the title policy, but that these do not?
It's both. We do not think they fall within the terms of this policy, but specifically as to this case, they do not as well. Judge Cannelli found that causes of action refers to affirmative claims that are being brought that you've said you will defend, not to affirmative defenses. We think he's right with respect to the language, but even if he's not, in this case, the affirmative defenses do not relate to title.
Right, but considering the title context, it seems to me that causes of action affecting or challenging title, which is what your policy covers, would often take the form of an affirmative defense to a foreclosure action. That's formally how these cases often arise, right?
It actually could be both, yes, affirmative defense or a counterclaim. And we defended the counterclaims. We defended the independent action that was filed in Chancery. And some of the affirmative defenses overlap claims that are being made in those very claims that we're defending.
Right, so but a decision from us that says affirmative defenses are never fall within the coverage of a title policy would be a bit of an overreach, I would think.
I think it would be contract-specific, and you're right. You wouldn't have to go there to rule in our favor. And finally, I did want to raise the issue, Judge Flom. I think you raised it at the end when he's referring to the website. If you look at Illinois case law and the Consumer Fraud Act, the two issues they raised with respect to the attorney guidelines, and they're the only two issues they raise, is that we wouldn't pay for multi-attorney conferences and that their time entries had to be specific. And so the question is, does that rise to the level of offending public policy under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act that requires moral, unethical, oppressive, or unscrupulous, or causes substantial injury? And we would respectfully say no. And so we would ask for the relief that the summary judgment be reversed, and that with respect to the various claims that are repled solely for purposes of appeal, that those are not considered active claims. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.